I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:18 on Tuesday, February 17, and we're here in room 120. Please remember to mute all cell phones. Members present include Representative St. Clair, Representative McCabe, Representative Holland, Representative Himshute, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary today is Cheryl Cole, and our moderator from the Juno LIO is Renzo Moises. Our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay, so thank you all for helping us today. We do have five items on today's agenda. We will do our best to get through as many of the items as possible. We will do completion of our amendment process on House Bill 124 related to ADA. Following that, we will have invited and public testimony on House Bill 250 from Representative Hannon. Then we have a reintroduction and invited testimony on House Bill 152 from Representative Galvin. And then as time allows, we will attempt to get to House Bill 130 and House Bill 278 today as well from Representative Josephson and Representative Costello. The first item on today's agenda is the continuation of our amendment process on House Bill 124 related to the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, from my office. This is our seventh hearing on the bill, and today we will continue the amendment process that we started last Thursday, February 12th. As we have a very full agenda today and we have had a very robust discussion on this legislation, I would just ask members to try to keep their comments as concise as you can, and we'll still respect people's desire to offer amendments and speak to them. Today we are joined by Executive Director Randy Raro on the phone, and for members' information, we are going to start with amendment number 8, which was also known as Amendment N.8. At our previous hearing, we had put this amendment on the table, and I will move that we take Amendment 8, also known as N.8, off the table. Seeing no objection, Amendment number 8, also known as N.8, is once again before us. It was previously moved, so it is before us for discussion. Do we have any discussion on amendment number 8? I'll turn to Rep. McCabe first.
Yeah, do you want me to present it, I suppose? So, yeah, amendment number 8 deletes section 8. Currently, ADA can keep its assets without being rated by the legislature if it pays the required or satisfactory statutory dividend. Under HB 124, ADA's assets are no longer separate from the state. ADA cannot keep any assets over the threshold and must pay these funds along with the current statutory dividend to the legislature. I did get a legal memo on this. If you don't mind me reading it into the record, Chair Carrick, I'd appreciate it. That's a request. It's fast.
Okay.
I can read fast. It said, related to ADA's finances, the limit on the value of ADA's funds and accounts in Bill Section 8 is somewhat novel. I'm aware of only one other statute that imposes a limit on the value of a fund. Like the limit for ADA's funds in Section 8, this other statute provides that money in excess of the limit lapses. There are many other statutes governing lapsing money, but these statutes ordinarily simply provide that money lapses at the end of a specific period of time, not money. I do not know how the court would evaluate the limit in Bill Section 8, especially in the context of ADA's unique statutory financial structure, as explained further below. ADA's governing statute, even as amended by this bill, raised potential constitutional issues with ADA's existing financial structure. In other words, the money does not belong to the state. ADA actually works for the executive branch, so there's a separation issue in there. It basically says funds, income, or receipts of ADA may not be considered or constitute money of the state. So I don't know how constitutionally this section will even hold up. So hence I offered the amendment to just remove it.
And Representative McCabe, I appreciate the legal memo. We do have a later amendment, which I alluded to at the last hearing, but that I feel addresses the considerations that this amendment was brought forward on and a couple other items. And I'm going to oppose this amendment, but only because I do think the later amendment addresses this more thoroughly. And I do appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. What I'd like to do at this point is make this my formal request, and I'll do it via letter if I can, that any and all legal memos from any and all of us be submitted with the bill and put into basis so that my constituents can understand exactly what we're dealing with here instead of just the snippets that we're allowed, that we have time to present.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. If that legal memo can be sent to our office, we'd be happy to upload it. Same for any committee members. If you do receive legal memos, please, regarding any legislation before this committee, please send them our direction. We'd be happy to upload them.
Thank you.
Is there additional discussion on Amendment 8? Seeing none at this time, I suppose I hadn't formally objected to the amendment when we brought it off the table, but I do object to the amendment, and I maintain that objection, so I'd ask the clerk to please call the roll on Amendment Number 8.
On HB 124, Amendment 8, Representative Story.
No.
Representative Hemshoot.
No.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance. Absent. Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative St. Clair.
Yes.
Chair Carrick.
No.
Three yeas, three nays.
And on a vote of three yeas and three nays, Amendment Number 8, also known as N.8, has not been adopted. At this time, at the request of Representative Holland, who came to speak with me about it, we have a couple of very similar amendments from Representative Holland, and it's my understanding that Representative Holland would like to offer Amendment Number 20, also known as N.17, first. Representative Holland.
I move Amendment Number 20.
And I'll check. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce this amendment. Amendment 20 has kind of three primary aspects to it. The first aspect to it is the removal of the cap, identical to the discussion we just had on Amendment 8, and in part is why I supported Amendment 8, because they are completely consistent in removing the $3 billion cap of the current bill. The second part of this amendment is an important one and the subject of the legal memo that was, I believe, shared with everybody and is a matter of record on basis that addresses the fundamental question of whether or not the net income of ADA is or isn't available to the legislature for appropriation. ADA and indeed some of the current statutes have suggested that income is shielded from the legislature. The legal opinion we have, indeed the consistency of other corporations, suggests that in fact that income should be available to the legislature for appropriation. So this amendment would clarify that the income of ADA is available to the legislature for appropriation, and it repeals those statutes that would be in conflict with that. The third part of this amendment then has some language that suggests that 20% of that net income would go back to ADA in order to recognize the importance of adding to some of their corpus as well as inflation-proofing some of their funds. It also goes one step further in specifically identifying some money to be appropriated into a innovation-driven enterprise investment fund to invest in emerging businesses aligned with our state's adopted comprehensive economic development strategy. and an innovation-driven incubator grant program to be able to fund startups. I think, as many of you know, I have put a great deal of time and effort over the last 10 years into how to grow and accelerate our otherwise stagnant economy. And I saw this as a way to align ADA's intent of economic development and job creation with the emerging sectors that our state's adopted comprehensive economic development strategy says that we will invest in. So this amendment is intended to align ADA with both its constitutional its statutory intent, but also to align it with the Constitution in the legislature's role. However, recognizing that the level of specificity in the funding of these new investment funds and the Innovation Grant Program may violate the confinement clause of the Constitution, I'm now going to withdraw this amendment from consideration so that we can turn our attention to another version of this amendment that does not have these specific appropriations. So I withdraw this amendment.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holland, and also thank you for your work in this specific area, too. So that amendment number 20, also known as N.17, has been withdrawn, and we will now go back to the original queue on the amendments and go to amendment number 17, also known as N.18. Representative Holland.
I move amendment 17.
Correct.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. And I will not belabor the introduction I already gave. Most of what I mentioned previously with the Amendment 20 that I've withdrawn applies here. Amendment 17 still removes the cap, consistent with Amendment 8 that we previously discussed. It also still identifies that the net income of ADA is subject to full legislative appropriation, and it does still include the budgeting allocation of 20% of that revenue back to ADA. What this amendment does not do is it does not fund the innovation grant program or the economic development fund that I'd proposed in Amendment 20. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holland. Before we go to Representative McCabe, I do have actually very brief ideas. House State Affairs is back on the record. Before we go back to the underlying discussion on this amendment, there is a conceptual amendment to the amendment. I'm going to move conceptual amendment 1 to amendment 17, and I'll object to briefly describe what this does. So on page 3, line 29 of amendment 17, this conceptual amendment deletes reference to 44.88.380. This is the employee liability section that we had removed from the bill previously in Amendment 13. So we adopted an amendment which removed this section. Should the underlying Amendment number 17 pass without this conceptual amendment, we would be adding back in language that the committee already rescinded. And so it was Ledge Legal's guidance that it could be taken care of potentially with technical and conforming changes, but it would be simplest if we were to make sure that this amendment conforms to the previous work of this committee. So removing this language from the amendment ensures the language that we had previously removed from the bill is still removed should the amendment be adopted. With that explanation out of the way, hopefully that's clear as mud. Are there any questions regarding that conceptual amendment?
If I may, can you clarify with your conceptual amendment, is inserting 44.88.088 still going to be inserted?
Yes.
Thank you.
I don't see any additional discussion. I'm going to remove my objection on the conceptual amendment. Is there any additional objection? Okay, seeing none, conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment 17 is adopted. And now we're back on the underlying Amendment Number 17. I saw Representative McCabe in the discussion.
Thanks. So this amendment is absolutely 100% unconstitutional. We can't take money from the executive branch in this manner. And even if we could, why are we not doing it to the Alaska Railroad, the Permanent Fund Corporation? No other public corporation is being capped, micromanaged, or structurally altered like this. So, you know, we call this the ADA Accountability Act. This is absolutely there is an underlying agenda here that I've written about extensively and we've talked about extensively here. If this policy is good governance, then let's apply it to all corporations. Why don't we apply it to the Alaska Railroad or to AHFC? If not, then this is targeted at ADA for some reason, and I think we all know how I feel about that. You know, ADA finances small manufacturers. It does exactly what you say, Representative Holland, that you want to do. It increases the economic churn in Alaska. It increases jobs. It finances energy infrastructure. It finances rural projects. It finances public-private partnerships. And when you destabilize ADA, as we are attempting to do right now, we destabilize our development. And frankly, it hits rural Alaska the hardest. This bill contracts opportunity in a state already struggling to attract capital because we are so rural, and some of our projects and businesses that are desired don't make much sense in a state like Alaska. So if you ask me, this is what I call structural sabotage of a public corporation that's owned by the state of Alaska that's done really good work in the last 3 decades. So, you know, if you want stronger reporting requirements, then let's draft the reporting requirements. If you want enhanced audit transparency, let's pass it. But, you know, I think that this is targeting ADA for the specific reason of removing funding from projects that the environmentalists do not want. They see that Trump has, the president has passed a bunch of regulation relief. He's encouraged Ambler. He's encouraged ANWR. And this is the environmentalists' last-ditch attempt to sabotage those projects. And I think it's wrong. I just think it's wrong. We have a great corporation here, and we are absolutely sitting here in this committee doing it a huge disservice. It isn't about accountability. It's about control. And I think we are making a huge mistake.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. I have Representative Holland and then St. Clair.
Great. Thank you. Just two brief comments. One is, to be clear, this amendment does not take away any of ADA's corpus. None. It takes away their net earnings after all their expenses. So they retain all of their money, $1.7 billion of that. So I want everyone to be clear that this is removing the cap and it's not removing any of the corpus. Second, though, in terms of this issue of the legislature appropriating money from ADA, I would refer folks to the legal memo, and perhaps if you want at this point to ask Ian Walsh from Legislative Legal Services to perhaps comment on his memo and this question of, is this unique, what we're trying to do with ADA, or is this actually more like what we in fact do with our other corporations, to clarify that point.
We can definitely ask him. Ian Walsh is online right now for questions. And Mr. Walsh, if you heard that, if you could put yourself on the record and provide an answer.
For the record, this is Ian Walsh from Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, to Representative Holland's question, I guess it's a multifaceted question, and the committee has already sort of discussed a little bit about the appropriations question, but essentially ADA is a public corporation, and it is also likely an instrumentality of the state for the purposes of the Alaska Constitution, which means that the Alaska Constitution's restrictions would apply to the legislature's governance of ADA, One of those restrictions in the Constitution relates to the legislature's authority to dedicate state revenue for particular purposes. So the Constitution has a dedicated funds clause that essentially prohibits the legislature from dedicating public revenue to special purposes with very limited exceptions. And the purpose of this clause was to allow the legislature and the governor to decide funding priorities annually on the merits based on the various proposals presented, and also to preserve control of and responsibility for state spending in the legislature and the governor. So to the extent that the statutes that govern ADA are intended to sort of remove the legislature and the governor's ability to use the appropriations process to control the state spending, that would seem to violate the purpose and presumably also the way we've interpreted the dedicated funds clause. And what that means is that the ADA is still subject to appropriation, just like most other public corporations. It is important to note that the railroad is an exception. The railroad has a federal statute that requires that its revenues be essentially managed by the railroad. And so the railroad is not subject to the legislative appropriations process in the same way as the other public corporations because of the preemptive effect, essentially, of federal law. The permanent fund income is appropriated by the legislature in the budget process, as is the income of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And I would be glad to answer further questions or clarify anything as the committee would like.
Thank you. I'm going to turn to Representative St. Clair now.
Oh, I forgot my question. He got me so riled up. Thank you. I threw the chair. I usually talk loud enough. Through the chair, just more of a statement. This is us as the state getting into the weeds on an organization that has been successful. We can argue constitutionality, both sides. The bottom line is this organization has been successful. And due to – I'm not even going to go there – it's been successful. Let's leave it alone. You know, these types of corporations with the public-private partnerships excel. They're what make or what create growth in the state. And I think this is just in general, the bill I don't like, and the amendment I'll be voting no.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. Do we have additional discussion, Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So if you don't mind, Madam Chair, Director Ruraro is on and he has some different legal advice than we got from Mr. Walsh. And if you wouldn't mind, I suspect he has it with him, has to do with some previous court cases that basically kind of refute what Ledge Legal is saying. So if you wouldn't mind, I'm hopefully that he has it on board. I haven't talked to him about it, so
we won't hold him against him if he doesn't have it off the top of his head. But Executive Director Ruraro, do you have a comment on the legal question here?
I do. Through the chair, this is Randy Ruraro, Executive Director for ADA. Just to the constitutional issues and questions, a couple of comments. One is the Alaska Supreme Court in the DeArmond case, 1962, has already addressed the issues of the legislature's delegation of authority to ADA to spend funds and to separate itself and to define ADA's funds as not subject to appropriation, and that's a constitutional power that comes to the legislature through Article 2, Section 1, wherein all legislative power is vested in the legislature. So there's a question, I guess, of whether the legislature had the power to basically exempt public corporations and separate them from their appropriation authority, at least until a bill passed changing that. And, you know, the impact of a finding that no public corporation could protect its earnings would radically affect the ability of these corporations to issue bonds. I think the railroad, frankly, would disagree with that analysis as well, since In the Statehood Act, the federal government agreed to accept the Alaska Constitution, including any dedicated funds clause. So if a later passed statute tried to exempt the railroad from that effect, it would be null and void in my view. So there's a lot of constitutional issues wrapped up in these questions. Ada believes that the Armin case is still good law. There's not been any Alaska Supreme Court case that's reversed it. And so we would rest on that. And there's other provisions of the Constitution as well. There's a section in Article 9 that gives public corporations the constitutional authority to issue revenue bonds. That implies some ability of separation of revenues to fund those revenue bonds. If that wasn't the case, you know, if our revenue was able to be taken in full, then that constitutional provision in Article 9, I think it's Section 13, would have basically no value. So lots of legal issues, I think, Chair, wrapped up in these questions. I'm not sure there's been a definitive case since De Armin addressing those.
Thank you, Executive Director Raro. I know that there is conflicting opinion on the interpretation of this amendment and its legality. I might just ask Mr. Walsh if you have any response comments to the De Armin case or any other comments from the Executive Director Raro that you'd like to provide.
Thanks, Madam Chair. To the Chair, this is Ian Walsh from Legislative Legal Services. The main note about mostly just about the Darman case is that that case did not involve a challenge related to the dedicated funds clause of the Alaska Constitution. The Darman case involved the challenge that was related to other pieces of ADA's statutory scheme, including whether the legislature can make appropriations to ADA, whether there was an improper delegation of authority to ADA to and then whether ADA was an independent agency sort of outside the bounds of the executive branch. And Darman upheld ADA in the face of these challenges, but it did not doesn't have, as far as I am aware, anything to say about the dedicated fund question. And then I guess the other note would just be that in 1982, the Attorney General, right after this foundational case interpreting the dedicated funds clause to apply to basically all public revenue, talks about some implied exceptions to that, the dedicated funds clause. There was not one identified for all public corporations, but there was one identified for revenue that was pledged for bonds that were issued under, that were basically that all public corporations are allowed to issue. And so that would be a dedication that may be permissible. But Mr. Raro is correct that I am not aware of a case that directly addresses these issues at all, and certainly not a case that addressed these issues as they relate to ADA since Darman.
So I really appreciate that, Mr. Walsh, and Executive Director Raro. The underlying thread that I'm hearing from both testimonies is that we are in somewhat of uncharted legal territory. I think that with this amendment number 17, I am in support of this amendment because I believe that it addresses a primary objection about the cap on the funds. And while that was a really strong motivation from a lot of constituents that had reached out to me for this bill, I believe that this amendment is a lot more deft at navigating the kind of structural challenge that many individuals have with how ADA is structured, while removing a cap, which has, I think, a lot clearer legal challenges to it. So I'm hearing that we're in some uncharted waters here. I respect the opinion of Director Raro and others about potentially not wanting to wade into those, but I do, in hearing the testimony from both parties, maintain my support. And I, as the sponsor of the bill, I don't take the discussion on this lightly. It's something that I do want to see continued going forward. This bill is in its first committee of referral, so I appreciate Rep. Holland from bringing the amendment forward. Do we have additional discussion on Amendment 17? I'd also like to recognize that Representative Vance has joined us at 3:47. I don't see any additional discussion. I'm guessing the objection is maintained. I'm going to assume so. Will the clerk please call the roll on Amendment 17, also known as N.18?
Regarding House Bill 124, Amendment 17 as amended. Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Hemsheet.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, Amendment Number 17, also known as N.18 as amended, has been adopted. This brings us to Amendment Number 18, also known as N.16. It's my understanding, Representative Holland, that you might wish to withdraw this amendment.
That's correct. I'm withdrawing 18.
Okay. Amendment Number 18, also known as N.16, has been withdrawn, and that brings us to the final amendment, Amendment Number 19, Representative Holland.
I move Amendment Number 19.
Hearing
Object.
No. There we go.
I haven't seen it yet.
I was going to be surprised there, Representative St. Clair. So hearing an objection, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, Chair Carrick. And quite frankly, it would not have surprised me if there was no objection. This amendment, I think, is straightforward and practical in light of trying to find some balance in the work we're doing with ADA. It does essentially two things. One is it clarifies that while we retain the language around having public comments posted and available, although with personal identifiable information redacted, it does not require ADA to have to respond to all of the public comments, which I think we agree would be particularly onerous for them and inconsistent with what we see in other public processes. So it retains the publication of public comments without personal information, but removes their requirement to comment all. Secondly, is it makes some changes here with regard to clarifying the conflict of interest requirements in order to protect the decisions that are made and the participation in those decisions. So with that, I will give it back to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative McCabe.
Why would we ever want to do that? Why would we want to remove identifying information so the entire state of Colorado could comment on an ADA bill? We would redact all their identifying information, and then there would be, you know, a couple million comments against something that ADA was doing, and none of them came from the state. No, this is a public process. You should have, if you're going to comment, then you should know that it's going to be public. I don't have a problem with it. You can look through, unfortunately, you can look through many previous pieces of legislation before I was elected and find some pretty strongly written emails from me that are probably rather not see, but the point being is I wrote them and I fully expected them to be public, and that's what a public process is. So why would we ever redact their names and their identifying address? I get, frankly, I get emails from a lot of folks that come from one email address. It's got a different name on it, but each one of them has it's one email address, and I can't respond. So how am I supposed to respond to that, right? So I couldn't object more to this. It violates the public process, in my opinion.
I see a lot of comments. I am actually curious about that same question, Representative McCabe, and I want to jump in and maybe ask the sponsor of this amendment if you would be open to further clarifying the amendment so that contact information would be redacted as opposed to names of individuals.
Yeah, to the chair, that would be fine. The intent here was to try and preserve some sort of confidentiality in terms of contact information that could be used. I would ultimately, though, you know, encourage any modification here that is consistent with other public process, but public process that provides some protection with people. I know that most of the information I see that we get has emails redacted off of a lot of the contents, which is, you know, I think what was imagined here. So I'd be happy with that. If there's a conceptual amendment you'd like to make that clarifies this, that's consistent with normal public process.
Let's go to Vice Chair Story and then Representative St. Clair. And then by that time, I may have come up with a conceptual amendment to potentially offer.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. My comment was, I know that we have redacted information on the letters that we got today, and I was wondering if the counsel online, Ian Walsh, would know what we typically have in our public process, because as a committee co-chair, we always have to make sure redacted information when we post things from the public is there. It has their name, but not how you can get a hold of them, so the public isn't writing back and forth to each other. So that is common practice, and so if we could have Ian Walsh comment.
Mr. Walsh, given that you've listened to our committee discussion, I guess we're editing live, but do you have a suggestion for how we could conform the intent in this amendment to standard practice?
To the chair, for the record, this is Ian Walsh from Legislative Legal Services. Drafting on the fly is never necessarily pretty. So I guess what I would say is I don't off the top of my head know exactly what language we would want to use to capture that. So I understand the committee is considering offering a conceptual amendment. I wish I could help with exact language, but unfortunately I think I would have to do a little digging in the statutes to figure out and get back to the committee about exactly what language to use.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Walsh. I appreciate it. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, just comments. You know, it's like what Rep. McKay brought up. It's, you know, this is supposed to be a transparency bill and we're hiding people's information. I know that we're talking about a conceptual amendment, but we don't have that conceptual amendment at this time. It needs to be on par with everything else. Every other organization, every standard that applies to every other organization when it comes to public comment needs to have, and we've all seen it, blocked out address, phone numbers, all we get is a name and possibly a city. So and without the conceptual amendment, Madam Chair, I can't vote for this.
Okay. Thank you, Representative St. Clair. I'll go to Representative Vance in just a second. So I'm going to move conceptual amendment number one to amendment number 19. On page one, line three of the amendment, the language would say, insert all public comments received in writing with personal contact information redacted.
I would object. Sorry.
Okay. There's an objection.
And to speak through the chair, to speak to my objection, is that standard language?
Representative St. Clair, to our legal counsel, Mr. Walsh's point, it's not, but what I'm intending to do with this conceptual amendment is get us a little bit closer to the intent of the sponsor of the amendment, recognizing that there will probably be additional work on this legislation, and we're trying to get a little closer to what we're hoping to see happen here. But I understand if you want to maintain the objection.
I maintain my objection.
Okay. Representative McCabe. And then I have a couple people in the queue, so we're going to go around.
Thanks. We're just talking on this conceptual amendment here. I wouldn't mind asking Mr. Walsh what the common practice is for redacting information, if there is some sort of alleged legal memo or something to committee chairs asking to redact any information. I mean, if you look at AI, if you've seen the wall of bots that are cell phones, it would be really, really easy to manufacture names from a voter database, manufacture email addresses, and send them all to us, and we would have no idea if the public process was actually followed. Whereas if there is contact information, a phone number, even a city, and we could call that person and verify that they actually put in this public comment. To me, anyways, the question is to Mr. Walsh, what is the standard practice recommended by Ledge Legal for committee chairs when they get public comments in via email?
Mr. Walsh, that question is for you. And again, we're looking specifically at the legislature right now as an example.
Right. For the record, this is Ian Walsh, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Representative McCabe. I don't have at my fingertips the policy related to committee documents, and I do not generally advise in the area of legislative procedure, but I will, while the committee is talking, I can try to look that up and get back to you with at least a better answer.
I have a couple people in the queue. We are under the conceptual amendment right now. So do we have folks with questions or comments related to the conceptual amendment? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Ian Walsh. Are you aware of this type of prescriptive language in regards to other public corporations?
For the record, this is Ian Walsh. Through the chair to Representative Vance, I am not aware of this specific language, either in the conceptual amendment or the underlying amendment exactly, but I do know that most other corporations are subject to the Public Records Act, and so the general standards that apply under the Public Records Act would apply if the public corporations are subject to that act. Unfortunately, I do not have the specifics at my fingertips to answer any specifics on how the Public Records Act would apply to the personally identifiable or other information, personal contact information that is the committee is considering.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. So to my point is, I think this is really getting in the weeds of telling them how to cross their T's and how to dot their I's. And, I feel like they are quite capable of handling this area. I mean, we're saying that we want them to write responses. I think that's excessive in my mind. But going down this road of prescribing every little nuance on this public comment, I think is maybe not the best direction for us to go when it comes to how we want to offer guidance for ADA at this time.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Is there any additional discussion on the conceptual amendment this time? I see none. The objection is maintained.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to ask the clerk to please call the roll on conceptual amendment 1 to amendment number 19.
On House Bill 124, Conceptual Amendment 1 to Amendment 19. Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Hemshoot.
Yes.
Representative Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
So with a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 19 has been adopted. I just want to note before we go back to the underlying amendment 19 that I recognize there's an unanswered question here from Mr. Walsh about whether that is exactly the language that would satisfy the will of the committee. And I make the commitment as the bill sponsor to follow up on that going forward and ensure that the conceptual amendment that we just passed is appropriate to the intent if there's any changes that need to be made. With that said, we are on the underlying amendment number 19. We are under discussion. Is there any additional discussion on amendment number 19? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the sponsor of this amendment, area that hasn't been discussed is in on page 1, line 21, where it says page 5, line 9, following lease, insert, and then it has a whole paragraph. Can you, this is also, it appears to be talking about like conflict of interest. Can you talk about what this does and what the purpose of this is?
These, through the chair, these changes are providing some clarification on what is meant by having any sort of interest and including direct interest in here in terms of the primary function of this section of the bill, which is to describe when a member of the authority may not vote on a resolution. So moving down then, this section is saying that if a member has some sort of direct or indirect interest in the action being taken by the authority, that they cannot vote on that. This last section that you're referring to that's being added after lease is further clarifying what that interest or indirect interest might be that would trigger them being prohibited from voting, including if that member is perhaps tied through, it describes here, an intermediary, a trust, or other arrangement, or if the member has an excessive amount of interest in those items. So it's just clarifying that we are trying to separate a member who's voting if they are somehow benefiting or somehow a party to the organization that would be affected by the decision being made by the authority.
Follow up. So are board members already not required to adhere to conflict of interest rules?
Thank you. Through the chair, I wouldn't want to speak to what the board members currently are not limited to. I think this section was trying to provide some additional clarification. I would defer to potentially Executive Director Raro if there are existing prohibitions. I'm generally, though, aware, you know, that in some of our public bodies, we don't seem to have a very strong conflict of interest policy, and I refer to our own body that seems to not be as stringent as we might want in this. And as a past fund manager myself, I know I was bound by very strict additional requirements like this. I could not touch or vote on any sort of investment that I was somehow tied to or my family was tied to or I had any interest. So from my standpoint, this is wholly consistent with other investment decision separation to protect those insider dealing and indirect things. But I don't know the current board policies.
Chair Kerr, do we have...
We do, Representative Vance. And also, I just want to note that currently in statute, members of the ADA board cannot vote on direct interests. There's no language around indirect interests, but we could turn to Executive Director Raro for standard practice of the board if you would like.
Well, if we're already required that, we would have to, if we're going to greatly expand what this conflict of interest is for members, we need to discuss what that is, because this even includes the words "or other arrangement." Well, what does that mean? And Alaska's a very small state when it comes to finding people who have the background and insight to serve on this board. And maybe their cousin, somewhere. I know that in the fishery, we deal with this a lot. And it's not out of anyone acting out of impropriety. It's just that we're a small state and people know each other and related. And so I have a lot of caution by taking the conflict of interest further than what is already required of the board that is in statute. And just, I would appreciate Mr. Raro's insight on the impact that this language that in this amendment can make.
Executive Director Raro.
Yes, to the chair and or through the chair, Representative Vance. Currently, there is the ADA statute, which discusses direct interest, but ADA interprets the statutes to include, or the limits on board member conflicts to include the Executive Branch Ethics Act prohibitions as well, which do apply to board members generically. And so that definition, there is definitions already set out in the Executive Branch Ethics Act, I think, that address this issue, which would mean that if this language was adopted, you would then have potentially another standard explaining what indirect is that is different from what applies to every other board member in the Executive Branch Ethics Act. So it may be worthwhile to stick with the current definitions, not only in the ADA statutes, but as supplemented by the Executive Branch Ethics Act, just for consistency across the different boards and agencies.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Raro. Is there additional discussion? I'm going to turn to Representative Holland for wrap-up at this time, just in consideration of the rest of our calendar.
Yep, great. Thank you to the chair. So to summarize, this amendment does two things. One is it removes a very onerous requirement that's in the current draft of the bill. This is trying to make work easier for ADA by eliminating the requirement that they have to respond and publish their responses to all requirements. So I think we can all agree that this is going to help ADA out tremendously in terms of their workload and their response. The second is that the current draft of the bill identified that if somebody had an indirect ownership, that they wouldn't be able to vote on it. This amendment did not introduce that indirect clause. This amendment seeks to provide clarification to what do we mean if we're going to have indirect as a criteria, and it specifically is identifying that this indirect interest is defined in this amendment to help clarify that indirect means that they're somehow going to have a financial benefit from the interest and therefore shouldn't be participating in votes. So this was simply providing clarification to the bill's language around indirect. We didn't introduce indirect in this. We're clarifying it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holland. I imagine that the objection is maintained. Will the clerk please call the roll on amendment number 19, also known as N.19?
House Bill 124, Amendment 19. Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Hemshoot.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
Four yeas, three nays.
With a vote of four yeas and three nays, amendment number 19, also known as N.19, is adopted. We're going to take a brief recess. House State Affairs is back on the record. Representative Hemshoot.
I move to reconsider Amendment 19.
Okay. I see no objection. We have Amendment number 19, also known as N.19, before us. Just for the record, there was a small procedural error in how the amendment was read. The objection was maintained, and we went to a vote. I would ask the clerk to call the roll on amendment number 19, also known as N.19, as amended.
House Bill 124, Amendment 19, as amended. Representative Hemshoot.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Story?
Yes.
Chair Carey?
Yes.
Four yeas, three nays.
Okay. And with a vote of four yeas and three nays, amendment number 19 as amended has been adopted. Thank you for that catch. Okay, so after a very robust discussion, we do have House Bill 124 as amended before the committee. I just want to remind members, we do have a few public testifiers on. We have a couple other bills on the calendar today. I'm going to offer each person a chance for any wrap-up comment on House Bill 124, but I would ask, if possible, to keep your comments fairly concise, just in consideration of the rest of the calendar today. And because we've gone through seven hearings on this bill, we've had a pretty good debate on it. So I will turn to see what comments we have. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just I'll make it brief. I've said from the beginning, I don't like this bill. I think it's unnecessary. And it's basically taking a stick and poking it in Ada's eye on purpose. With that, I will be a do not pass.
Representative St. Clair. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I will just focus on two issues that I see with this bill, constitutional issues that were written out in this legal memo that I have. The first is the separation of powers with the board appointments. Legislative Legal clearly states in their memo that requiring legislative confirmation of ADA board members likely violates the separation of powers. ADA is not a principal department. It's not a quasi-judicial agency. It does not fall under the narrow constitutional categories that allow legislative confirmation. Appointment of subordinate executive officers is an executive function, not a legislative function. So this bill encroaches directly into the governor's constitutional authority. And then it compounds the problem by removing or muddying the removal authority. Who can remove the members that are appointed by the legislature? So if we pass this legislation, we know that it likely violates the Constitution. That's not reform. That's political theater. Second issue that I have is the LBNA approval. That's a legislative veto by another name. We don't get to veto things. The governor gets to veto things. Requiring LBNA approval before ADA can expend over $100 million creates a legislative veto structure. LBNA approval is not subject to gubernatorial veto. So that also is constitutionally suspect. If the legislature wants oversight, we pass laws. We don't create shadow veto powers inside committee structures. Once again, this is a separation of powers issue and violates the Constitution. I could go on for an hour, probably, on this bill and the constitutionality of it and the reasons for it. But I'm pretty sure you already know how I feel. But I wanted to get at least those two points on the record because it's likely to go to the courts. And I want that on the record that we did this knowing that it was unconstitutional.
I would just point out, Representative McCabe, that we are the first committee of referral and the first body of referral. So just to clarify, the bill doesn't go from here to the courts. It goes from here to the House Finance Committee. They have a lot of legislation in their committee. So I just want to be clear, and I appreciate your comments and the discussion. Do we have additional comments? Representative Vance?
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I appreciate that you were bringing forth a concern from your constituents about what many of our constituents feel like was just a bad public process with ADA for a long time. And just things felt very secretive, and they kept going into executive session, and people didn't know what was going on, and they didn't even know if their public testimony was being heard. I heard, you know, that my constituents voiced that, and I'm glad that we've seen a positive turnaround with ADA. They have been making strides to show that they are listening. They do want to have community engagement, and I think that is a definite step in the right direction. We want to see that to continue, and I hope that they are embedding that into the fabric of who they are, not just with the current people there, because unfortunately we don't get to keep good people forever. I think this is one of those lesson learned type of things because there was such a public outcry. So I highly respect bring forth legislation that can continue to encourage ADA to move in that direction. However, I feel like this bill goes too far on a lot more areas besides just the public engagement area that I've heard from my constituents, and so I'm not able to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Vice Chair Story?
Thank you, Chair Carrick. It is interesting, you know, the legal opinion that's posted on BASIS that we have says ADA is a public corporation and likely an instrumentality of the state for the purposes of the Alaska Constitution. And I think what I took behind this bill coming forward, and Rep. Vance and Rep. Carrick, you both said it, it's trying to build public confidence in this corporation, in this entity. And I see adding seats on the board, one appointed by the Senate president, one person appointed by the Speaker of the House. I think that is, and there's some other things in here that I think really help ADA be stronger and have the public feel more confident in the decisions that are made by ADA. So I will be supporting the bill at this point, and I realize that it has a long ways to go, but I just appreciate the thought and everyone's thoughts on it. So thank you.
I see no additional comments. So as I am the sponsor of the bill, I'd like to take the opportunity for a very brief wrap up. First and foremost, I just really appreciate this committee for very robust discussion and work on this. I want to say, first and foremost, you know, when I brought the bill before us this session, I started out by saying that ADA performs a lot of good work in this state. And I maintain that statement. I appreciate Executive Director Raro engaging with the committee. And generally, I appreciate a lot of the work that ADA does. Unfortunately, they're not in the news for it very often. And a lot of the times that they've been in the news is related to transparency concerns, accountability concerns. And we've heard pretty loud and clear from a large number of communities and Alaskans that those concerns persist. This legislation is an attempt to have a discussion about better governance for ADA, and hopefully eventually not just a discussion, but a bill that is streamlined, which affects the areas that constituents have reached out to many of our offices about, and which allows ADA to successfully focus on its mission, which largely they've been very good at meeting. And I want that good story to be told more often. This committee has taken a robust amendment process. I just want to note that the committee substitute took into consideration feedback from ADA and the committee members. We took some actions to, as some would see it, weaken the bill, and I would see it as, you know, really honoring the wishes of the committee process. We removed the seat designated for an environmental advocacy organization. We increased the ADA revolving fund cap, and then we completely restructured it through this amendment process. We increased the threshold for project approval. We changed how that project approval would work. We changed and clarified requirements today around the conflict of interest rules. We changed the Attorney General approval on lawsuits. We changed a lot of components of this legislation. I believe that through that process, we have created a stronger bill. There are outstanding questions and considerations, and I'm cognizant of those. And I look forward to seeing this bill potentially continue in the legislative process. This is its first stop, not its last stop. So there's quite a lot of opportunity for continued discussion. And I just thank everybody for that process that we've had here, even though I know there's still strident objections from some. I'm assuming there's objection to moving this bill.
Yeah,
I have to move it first, or we have to move it first. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move House Bill 124, also known as 34-LS0411/N, as amended, with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Object. We didn't talk about the new fiscal note either.
I thought we did talk about it.
Don't you have to adopt that or move it?
Very, very brief at ease. Hold on. House State Affairs is back on the record. Just had a clarifying question there. We have done wrap-up commentary on the bill, so I would ask the clerk to please call the roll on House Bill 124, version N, as amended.
House Bill 124, Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Hemshire.
Yes.
Representative Pollard.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
So with a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 124, version N, as amended, has moved from committee. We're going to take a very brief at ease to sign the paperwork, and next on our agenda, when we come back, we'll be invited in public testimony on House Bill 250. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. Next on the agenda today, we have House Bill 250 on police face coverings from Representative Hannon. Originally, we were going to have additional committee discussion on the bill, but given the time constraint we have and the fact we do have in public testimony today, we're going to go straight to our invited testimony first and then open for public testimony on this bill today. I'd like to start with Chief Sean Case of the Anchorage Police Department. Thank you very much for joining us today. And if you would like to provide invited testimony, we'd please ask you to keep the testimony to 5 minutes, if possible.
Chair Carrick, Vice Chair Story, member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Sean Case. I serve as Chief of Police for the Anchorage Police Department and President of the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police. I want to be clear from the onset. I oppose police officers wearing masks to conceal their identity, and I oppose House Bill 250. Since 1974, officers have worn name tags to ensure trust and accountability. The same arguments made then, public trust versus officer safety, are being made today. Despite real risks of harassment and violence, officers have continued to serve openly with visible name tags and badges. That visibility is part of our responsibility to protect and serve our communities. Using officer safety or doxing as justification for masking is not valid. Local officers have faced these challenges for decades without hiding their identities. Over the last 60 plus years, officers have been on the front lines of riots that originated from police use of force incidents. These riots have been hostile, violent, and even criminal. Officers had been assaulted, spit on, and had objects thrown at them. The fear in some cases and the reality of violence, harassment, and stalking after these incidents is prevalent. And yet we keep our faces uncovered, our name tags visible, and we wear a badge with pride because we take an oath to protect everyone in our community. It has been suggested that HB 250 is pro-law enforcement, in that it strengthens public trust, but trust is earned through professional, compassionate, and community-oriented policing, not through legislation. Mandating policy decisions through law suggests that police cannot govern themselves, which undermines confidence in our profession. There's also been comments about federal law enforcement impacting or influencing local law enforcement. local law enforcement operates independently from federal agencies. In fact, local agencies often lead the way in transparency, such as adopting body-worn cameras, long before federal agencies followed. Federal laws, like 42 United States Code Section 1983, commonly known as the 1983 Civil Rights Act, and federal consent decrees, hold local departments accountable in ways that do not apply to federal agents for violating constitutional or federal rights while acting under color of law. This bill confuses those distinctions and addresses a problem that does not exist in Alaska. I believe this bill is unnecessary and practical and impractical. Masking is not a practice in Alaska, and enforcing this bill would be impractical, giving it numerous exemptions. It attempts to solve a non-existent issue while inserting local law enforcement into a debate about federal immigration enforcement, something outside our role and responsibility. I want to conclude about our commitment to the public. At our core, local and state law enforcement officers are public servants. We live in the communities we protect, we know the people we serve, and we are accountable to them. Our mission is not political, it is personal. Every day we show up to help, to protect, and to serve with integrity and transparency. We do not need masks to do our job, we need trust, connection, and the continued support of communities we proudly serve. This legislation detracts from that mission. It places local officers in the middle of a national debate that has nothing to do with how we serve Alaskans. HB 250 will not improve safety, trust, or accountability. It will only create division. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Chief Case. Let's go to our other invited testifier, and then if we do have brief questions from the committee, we can take them. Let's go to Ms. Sarah Hybe. Probably saying that wrong, with the Alaska Police Standards Council in Juneau. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Chair Carrick, Vice Chair Story, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Sarah Hebe, and I serve as Administrative Investigator of the Alaska Police Standards Council. I am here to answer any technical questions you may have regarding the implementation and operational aspects of this legislation.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ms. Hebe. Sorry for the mispronunciation. We do have a number of public testifiers, so I will ask if folks can keep their questioning fairly limited today. I would also like to invite on the record Chief Case and Ms. Hebe to join us at any future bill hearings related to this issue. We'd be very happy to have you. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. I don't really have a question. I just would like to thank Chief Case and his officers publicly. My wife used to work for APD, and they have a tough job, and I admire his testimony. He is exactly right, and I admire his commitment to the community of Anchorage. So thank you, Chief.
Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the young lady, I don't want to butcher her name.
Ms. Hebe.
Hebe. Okay. Quick question for you, ma'am, through the chair. What is the stance of the Alaska Police Council training? Is there any rationale for potential masking of officers at pretty much any time other than life and safety, fire, et cetera, et cetera? Would there be any other reason that you would tell other police officers or other councils that they needed to mask?
Madam Chair Garrett, through you to Representative St. Clair. I don't have a good answer for that right at the moment. I do not know. And I would have to get back to you of other situations that would warrant that.
Follow up? Yes, ma'am. I made that a little ambiguous. Let me make it clear. Is there anything in your standards, in your training, that says that officers need to mask during to protect their identity during any time?
Madam Chair, through you to Representative St. Clair. Thank you for the clarification. There is nothing in our regulations that specifically address masking of police officers.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't see any additional questions at this time. Again, just want to welcome both of our invited testifiers and Ms. Heeb to be present at any future hearings. We'll be sure to make sure you know when they're happening from our office. At this time, we are going to open public testimony on House Bill 250. And we do have a number of people online. We'll go first to the Fairbanks LIO and James Aldridge. And if public testifiers could please limit your testimony to 2 or less minutes. Thank you for joining us.
Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you, Mr. Aldridge.
Okay. My name is James Aldridge, and I am a registered voter, and I support this bill, but I would like to see a number of amendments that we see every day in our local police officers and our state troopers, and I agree with that. But what I don't see in this bill, and this bill is mostly about ICE, you want to see number badge clearly displayed, a standardized uniform, and judicial warrants instead of those phony warrants that they give out to themselves. I would like to see that added to this bill. And that's all I got to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aldridge. We'll go next to James Manning, also at the Fairbanks LIO.
My name is James Manning. I live in the Fairbanks area. I also wholeheartedly support this bill. One change I would like to see is that the wearing of masks in combination with committing a crime such as assault would be raised to a felony. I have experienced firsthand intimidation by police officers on duty. This happened in Longmont, Colorado, not Alaska. And it's not involved a state police officer. No state police officer in any jurisdiction has ever caused me to fear for my own safety. But I did have several incidents in the city of Longmont where actions of the police officers did cause me to fear. And the wearing of masks is a form of intimidation. And while I agree with the Anchorage person who spoke, with regard to formal actions, I don't feel that specifically excluding wearing masks is any sort of muddying the water. It's clarification. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Manning. We do have testifiers in the room, so I'd like to turn now to if there's anyone in the room who would like to testify, come on up and put your name on the record.
Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bridget Smith, and I live in Juneau, and I support HB 250. A peace officer wearing a mask to conceal his face would immediately lead me to question that person's motives and distrust whether that officer was really there to protect and serve me or whether they wished to be unaccountable for their behavior. When I sat down here, I identified myself. I am not wearing a mask to conceal my face. None of you are wearing masks. None of you are concealing your identities. You are lawmakers why should law enforcement be allowed to wear masks? Masks are used by criminals to conceal their identities and by members of organizations which have terrorized Americans in the past. In the 1920s, the Klan rose again to intimidate and harm people of color and Catholics and Jews. In Yakima, Washington, when my grandfather ran for office, the Klan burned crosses on the hills around the city, as well as leafletting every house to tell voters that he was a Catholic and that his wife and children were Catholic too. The threat to his family was implicit. The Klan have always worn hoods to conceal their identities because they knew they were committing crimes. We have watched as ICE agents have behaved with impunity instead of integrity in Minneapolis and other places around the country while they were masked. They are not being held accountable for their criminal actions because we do not know who they are. I have respect, in fact, I have great respect for the members of Alaska law enforcement, but I have no respect or trust for someone who conceals his face to hide his identity. Instead, I have nothing but suspicion when I see someone who has sworn to serve and protect the public wearing a mask to conceal his identity from that same public. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Representative St. Clair, do you have a question?
I have a quick question for you, Ms. Smith.
Yes.
Through the chair, how many peace officers have you seen in Alaska wear face masks when performing their duties?
Through the chair, none, but we have ICE as a possibility in this state.
Follow up?
No.
Okay.
Actually, thank you, Ms. Smith, for your testimony.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, we're not going to, on any bill, question public testifiers unless there's something very burning in clarification of their testimony, as opposed to engaging in a dialogue with testifiers. But thank you, Ms. Smith, for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, we're going to go back online to Laura Lucas in Juneau.
Yes, hello. My name is Laura Lucas. I live here in Juneau in House District 4, and I'm calling in support of HB 250. I applaud the proactive introduction of this legislation in light of the tragic shooting of two citizens in Minneapolis. I'm hearing discussion that this police officers in Alaska are not masked, but I think that the public is responding to the fact that, you know, within the past year, we've seen changes in this country that we've never imagined would happen before. So I see this legislation as potentially proactive for an issue that might arise in Alaska. In my career as a social worker, I've had numerous trainings in de-escalation techniques, and they universally emphasize the potential strength of using verbal and nonverbal communication in stabilizing tense situations. It's pretty difficult to talk from behind a mask and use your voice to calm down an emotionally charged encounter. And so I think it's by inhibiting this ability to communicate verbally and with your face, that masks would significantly reduce the opportunity to resolve a situation without the use of force. I believe that instead, masks worn by law enforcement officers would promote fear and contribute to an us versus them mentality that erodes community trust and increases resentment towards police. As a student of human behavior and social psychology, I'm going to bring up another issue that I have not heard in this argument, and that is it's also important to consider that masks have the capacity to transform the wearer. In other words, when the facial covering provides this sense of anonymity, that in turn can lead that person to do things that they wouldn't do if they felt that they could be identified. So in sum, I just wish that you would consider the value of this legislation to promote trust and not fear in Alaskans' relationship with law enforcement officers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lucas. And we'll go now to Reza Smith in Anchorage. Ms. Smith, if you can hear us, we can't hear you. If you can unmute, if possible.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Oh, yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. I want to start off by thanking Representatives Hannah, Fields, and Nina for the introduction of this bill and, you know, responding to this pretty promptly. And I'm also going to thank Sean Case again for his comments. This bill is a little interesting just because it's not something that we're encountering as an issue with, you know, at least here in Alaska. It's something that's highlighted as a federal issue, a concern from constituents regarding conduct across the United States. It's a little interesting that we're having to do this in essentially a manner to protect ourselves, but unfortunately it is a necessary thing. I don't think this is something that is going to impact police safety. I don't think it's something that is going to impact weather or health. I mean, that's already provided for in the bill, and I also support potential amendments to the bill in order to kind of outline that. I think this is more a bill in response to what we are seeing across the United States, and I don't envy Chief Case because, unfortunately, this is not something that we're seeing from Alaska police. This is not a fault on the part of our officers. This is something from counterparts federally across the United States, and it is a small protection that people feel is necessary to protect their constitutional rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We'll go now to Bernie Hoffman in Fairbanks. And Ms. Hoffman, again, if you are muted, if you could unmute yourself. I think we'll come back to Ms. Hoffman. We can't hear you, but you are shown as available. So we have a couple more testifiers and we'll come back around. Let's go now to Luann McVeigh in Juneau. And same thing, we might have to come back to you, Ms. McVeigh. If folks are muted on their end, you do have to unmute in order to testify today. We'll come back in just 1 minute.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, there we go.
I'm sorry. I guess that I was muted by the LIO. Okay.
No worries.
I'll start over if you don't mind. I'm Luann McVeigh. I'm a retired Alaskan teacher. I live in Douglas. And I thank you for the opportunity for me to share my thoughts with you. I am testifying in support of HB 250, prohibiting city, state, and federal officers from wearing masks which conceal their identity while performing their duties. Wearing masks to conceal our identity brings to mind for me those white uniforms of the Ku Klux Klan that Bridget Smith mentioned earlier. And it also brings to mind the gray ski mask of Nancy Guthrie's kidnapper. Facial masking allows individuals to anonymously commit crimes against others, and this obfuscates accountability. This bill is crafted with specific exceptions that would apply to Alaskan situations. And by the way, I would like to commend Chief Case and the Anchorage Police for the wearing of badges, official uniforms, name tags, and body cams. And, you know, the Minneapolis residents probably did not believe that masked officers would be in their state. But when those federal ICE agents showed up wearing masks, violence came in their wake. And that's the reason why I hope that you will please pass HB 250 out of the committee, strengthening community relationships between everyday Alaskans and our peace officers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. McVeigh. And we'll go now to Paul Seaton and Homer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. This is Paul Seaton and Homer. I support HB 250. I know of no law enforcement in Alaska that intentionally disguise themselves from the public with whom they're interacting, and I would be opposed to them doing so. It would create a dangerous situation for a disguised, armed, masked person to interact with Alaska. I support this restriction applying to all law enforcement, both state and federal, and I support the name and badge being prominently displayed. Additionally, I suggest the term police being reserved for an officer who is authorized to enforce state and local laws. This would eliminate the confusion as to federal authorities who are not police. If an officer is military police or tribal police, that should be clearly stated. Confusion during interaction should be avoided, and HB 250 helps to avoid any confusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't know whether to call you representative or Mr. Seaton, but thank you. And we'll just circle back to Bernie Hoffman in Fairbanks.
Yes. Oh, yes. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Madam Carrick and the committee members. And of course, all Alaskans listening. Hey, I support this bill, this HB 220 or 250, for all political officials or officers, state, local, federal. I also support our local officers who don't mask up and who have a more difficult job than ICE. And we support them wholeheartedly. Let me see, where am I at my thing? I really appreciate that this bill is looking to the future to protect Alaskans, against the paramilitary buildup of ICE and detention centers that are going to be called future concentration camps for those who disagree with the current, the current move towards authoritarianism in our country. If you're being anonymous, it leads to the lack of trust, and that enables those who feel that they can act out with immunity. And we're seeing that in our country now, since national accountability is nil. So once again, thank you for your time and attention and for the future protection of our Alaskan residents. Thank you so much, and you have a good night. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bernie Hoffman. Appreciate hearing from you. That is everybody that's online to testify. I'll make one more call for folks in the room if there's anybody to testify. Seeing nobody, I'll go to Representative St. Clair.
Ms. Smith? Through the chair, I'd like to make a comment to Ms. Smith. Come on back in here, ma'am, if you would, please. I apologize for my comment earlier. I'm prior law enforcement, and it's kind of a sensitive target, and I apologize for being rude.
Well, thank you very much for your apology. And as I said in my testimony, I have great respect for law enforcement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. I appreciate that. Quite a lot. And I know there's a lot of strong feelings on this topic, so I don't want to limit discussion on the bill. I just
understood.
Want to limit it to the people in this room if we can. So I see no further public testimony, so we are going to close public testimony on House Bill 250. And the underlying bill is before us at this time. We are going to set House Bill 250 aside. I want members to be aware that we will be taking this bill up at future hearings, and as the chair's office, we will be inviting back our Alaska Police Standards Council folks, and Chief Cases will be welcomed as well. Thank you to the bill sponsor and staff also for being present today during the hearing. Amendment deadline. Okay. At this time, we are going to transition to House Bill 152. House Bill 152 is the education head tax legislation that was brought forward by Representative Galvin at our end of session last year. We did have two hearings on this bill. We took public testimony. We had some committee discussion and a presentation. This is our third hearing on this bill, but we are reintroducing it for the committee. And I'd like to ask Representative Galvin and her staff to briefly reintroduce the bill. And then my understanding is we have one invited testifier today on House Bill 152. We will take questions of that invited testifier as time allows at the end of the committee. And I would just note for members that, again, this is a reintroduction with one invited testifier. It is my intent to bring this bill up again, likely a couple of more times before we would take any action. So I will turn it to Representative Galvin, and we're pulling the presentation up. Very brief at ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. Thank you, Representative Galvin. Please feel free to do your brief reintroduction.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Representative Elise Galvin, and I am here with my staff, David Chang, to present House Bill 152. I know that several of you were not present the last couple of times this was presented, so what we're going to get is 2 minutes of a little quick recap. It's a broad-based high earners tax that will address our state shortfall in education funding, and there's also a flat tax as a portion of it. A flat head tax. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my staff to give you a quick, brief overview, and then we'll hear from Mike Bronson, who will share a bit more of the why this is necessary and how it might be used to support education.
To the chair, to members of the committee, my name is David Jang, legislative staff to Rep. Elise Galvin. I'm here to present House Bill 152. In the interest of time, since this bill was previously heard on the House State Affairs Committee in April last year, I'll provide a brief overview. And we'll transition to the first slide here. So this chart very briefly shows Alaska's current revenue sources. As many of you know, our state revenue relies on a three-legged stool, primarily petroleum production, permanent fund investment earnings from proceeds of past years, and federal funding. House Bill 152 proposes a broad-based tax on high earners with two components. The first is a 4% flat income tax on earnings above $150,000 for single filers and $300,000 for joint filers. And then, secondly, a $150 head tax on all wage earners in Alaska. According to the most recent fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, which all committee members should have in their binders, this would produce $300 to $350 million in revenue. This approach also closes the S-corporation loophole, captures revenue from high-earning non-resident workers who currently pay no state income tax, and stabilizes Alaska's fiscal situation while providing much-needed funding for public schools. One thing I'll note on record that is not mentioned on this slide is that Alaskans may choose to pay the head tax using portion of their permanent fund dividend. And just very briefly, this slide illustrates how the tax is applied at different income levels. Main thing I just want to point out here is that earnings below $150,000, so tax or $300,000 for joint filers are not subject to the 4% tax. So in other words, taxes only apply to dollars above $150,000 for single filers and $300,000 for joint. Only the $150 head tax applies. And we can speed through these slides. And thank you for your attention. And I'll now turn it over to Rep. Galvin if she has any comments before Mike Bronson's presentation.
I have no further comments. I look forward to hearing Mike Bronson. And thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Galvin, also for your extreme patience today as we run through a very large agenda. We are bringing this bill up again, so I just want to note that once more for committee members. This is just a reintroduction today. And I'd like to welcome Mike Bronson with the NAACP in Alaska to testify for us online. Mr. Bronson, you have up to 15 minutes to present testimony. Again, if there are questions from committee, we can relay them to our invited testifier. We will also welcome him back at any future hearing of the bill.
Hi, I'm Mike Bronson from Anchorage in Representative Hall's District 16. Thank you for inviting my testimony today. House Bill 152 promises a significant step toward compliance with the state constitution on the part of the legislature. David, if you or Stuart can show slide two.
We are transitioning the slides, Mr. Bronson, so we've got you there. If you just say next slide, we'll get you to the next slide.
All right. Can you see slide two?
We can.
The bill's income tax revenue can improve classrooms, close the student achievement gap with the rest of the United States, and bring the legislature into compliance with its duties that are specified in the court case of Moore versus Alaska. If you're looking at slide two, you'll see down in the bottom right, I put Judge Gleason's two criteria in quotation marks. She made it really clear that for a school to be legally adequate under the Constitution, that's your purview, a substantial majority of its students have to meet the proficiency standards for mathematics and English language arts and science. And even though we don't realize it as much, she made an even higher bar, in my opinion, that she said all children, each child of school age in Alaska must be given the opportunity to meet those standards. Not that they all would, but they all have to be given the opportunity to meet those state standards. And she was clear about this, regardless of the circumstances. It could be poor. It could come from trauma. It could be in a poor school. It's falling down under any circumstances, the state's obligated to give that child an opportunity to meet state standards. So on slide three, see an example that Alaska students have fallen one full year behind the rest of the USA in reading and math. Their scores on this federal test, NAEP test, they call it, they show that the learning decline as well as, they show a learning decline as well as Alaska's 1 year gap with outside students. So that black line at the top shows the USA average for fourth grade reading, and the yellow line toward the bottom shows Alaska. And you look toward the right, you can see that gap. That's more than a one-year gap. Our students are more than 1 year behind the rest of the USA. In slide four, you can see the red line shows the plummeting scores in this federal test. They're closely correlated to the shrinking buying power the legislature's base student allocation. The red curve shows about a one-year loss, for example, in eighth-grade reading over several years, starting about 2010-ish or so, and then dropping. And the blue dashed line shows the erosion of the base student allocation. As the BSA or the allocations fell, so did eighth-grade reading scores by a full year. I'll move to slide five. You can see that same blue line falling. That's the allocation falling over the decade or decade and a half. And with that, we can see that what they call pupil-teacher ratio went up as the allocation went down. That's the red line goes up, up, up until we're about almost, this year we're about 18 or so. The lower ranks of the states nationwide in terms of class sizes. PTR is just an index of class size, which is really difficult to find. Moving to slide six. As our scores worsen, that's the old red line there as our scores fell in this particular example. And the PTR, class size indicator, went up, up, up. So you can see the really tight correlation between rising class size indicators and falling scores. Let's move to slide 7. Just to point out to you, in the USA, on average, school spending has been beating inflation. And the green line shows a rising spending rates among most of the USA states. The gray line right below it shows inflation, and you can tell that spending, by and large, has risen faster than inflation across the USA in general. Move to slide 8, please. You can, if you've heard of the Mississippi Reading Miracle, which is a fantastic example for us to think seriously about when it comes to turning the reading skills of our kids around, you can see that it's not cheap. Even Mississippi increased its spending on K through 12 education in a big way as its reading scores went up. Far spending rate increases far in advance of inflation rates. Now contrast that to us on slide 9. Alaska school support does not beat inflation. Here, the gray line, inflation, is far higher than our spending rate. In other words, we're spending the slower and slower rate while inflation continues to rise. I want to shift gears and point out a little factoid that on slide 10, that some East Coast studies, headed by the governor, in fact, to show that in the face of it, Alaska as a state is generous to its schools. So when we looked at that study, we found out that they had completely ignored the permanent fund as a contributor to school budgets. So we talked to the authors of that study, reminded them and asked them about the permanent fund and got zero for an answer. And subsequent to that, they walked back their claim that Alaska ranked high in its generosity. If we were to throw in the permanent fund in their calculations, we'd find that Alaska ranks among the lowest states in terms of generosity and would fall more on the stingy side in terms of supporting its school students. And to come closer to home, our own university scholars, slide 11, look at the blue bar on the lower left. You can see that our own scholars compared Alaska spending rates per pupil to the lower 48. Took into account, in this case, cost of living differences among the regions. And they found, lo and behold, that in Alaska, after you've accounted for cost of living differences, at least spend 15% less on average than the lower 48 does on our per pupil student costs. So we'll take a quick peek at slide 12. It shows you what you already know, that most of our full funding comes from the general fund, which itself is largely derived from the permanent fund these days. Moving to slide 13, slowing down a bit. Those top two layers show roughly $400 million would make up for inflation since about 2011, and $200 million more per year could close the academic achievement gap between Alaska students and the U.S. average. Those are the top two layers, and they're stacked on top of the current K through 12 support. Now, to get down in the weeds a bit on slide 14, you can see a rough calculation of the $600 million that is estimated to account for both inflation makeup and closing the achievement gap. This is a rough extrapolation from the Anchorage School District's expert calculation up to a statewide scale, and it indicates about $600 million per year additional state funding would be most likely to provide legally adequate schools. About $400 million would make up for inflation's erosion of the school allocations, and another $200 million would improve classrooms further and close the grade level gap we have with the U.S. So to wrap up, I'll point out that House Bill 152's $300 million in revenue would add about half of the funding increases projected close the proficiency gap in students and to gain constitutional compliance for the legislature. I'm going to move to slides 15 and then 16. And I'll thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Bronson. Really appreciate your patience today as well and your presentation. I would like to again invite you to join us in any future hearings of this bill in case there are additional questions on the information we got today. I'd like to turn back to the bill sponsor. Do you have any additional comments for today, Representative Galvin?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I really don't have anything to add except that I know that the numbers that are in the in your packets are likely low because the numbers that the Department of Revenue was working with are from previous years. So we know that with Willow and Pika and others, there has been a little bit of a shift in high earners, and so we would be likely seeing a change upward shift of the revenue that we could expect if this bill stays as is. I know this is the first committee, so lots to work through, but I just wanted you to be aware that the $300 to $350 million is based on former years of data.
Thank you very much, Representative Galvin. I'd like to set the bill aside today. Representative Holland, do you have a very brief question?
Thank you. I'll follow up with the bill sponsor and do some work there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And like I said, this is the beginning of this is a reintroduction. Get this on the committee members' radar again. Remind us what the bill does, and we will be discussing it in a lot more detail in future hearings. But thank you, Representative Galvin and staff, and thank you to Mr. Bronson. I'd also like to recognize that we did not get to two bills that were previously noticed due to our overrun on the amendment process with the House Bill 124. So it is still my intention to bring up House Bill 130 from Representative Josephson, as well as House Bill 278 from Representative Costello at a future hearing, possibly under bills previously heard. We will communicate with the sponsors to set those times up. And with nothing else on our agenda, that concludes our business for today. Our next hearing is on Thursday, February 19th at 3:15 here in room 120. We will only have an hour for this hearing as we are yielding the second hour of our time to the Department of Administration Subcommittee. And at our hearing, we will have a presentation from the Alaska Department of Corrections and the Alaska Federation of Natives on the recently released report about Alaska Native incarceration rates in Alaska. For members' information, this report was requested by the legislature after passage of House Bill 66 in 2024. So that's our entire hearing on Thursday. A little less spicy than today. thank you all for a great committee once again. And at this time, House State Affairs is adjourned at 5:12 p.m.